My name's Amanda, and I'm a senior editor here with Praxis, the Fletcher Journal of Human Security at the Fletcher School. This is our first foray into audio, so I'll take a little bit of time to tell you who we are and what we're about. We're a student-run publication exploring the intersections between historically separate fields, such as development, human rights, humanitarianism, and conflict resolution. We're housed by the Henry J. Lear Institute at the Fletcher School, which seeks to advance human security through research, education, and policy engagement. But what exactly is human security? Well, some of the Praxis team sat down with Professor Kimberly Titan to answer just that.
Well, you know, human security to me is a much needed corrective to older militarized understandings, very state-centric understandings of security. However, I don't think it has to be the end-all of our thinking on these issues. Terms come and go out of vogue. What matters to me is the content in which we decide that we should really be focusing in a much broader understanding of security, what it means to be secure in this world, to understand the nuanced ways in which people define that, and to have it be and retain its critical edge. And that term may disappear, but the content won't. And the insistence on thinking about what it means for differently situated humans, some women, other genders, people of color, religious minorities, you name it, what security means. And I think that these are such intersectional problems that Des Gaspers describes human security as a boundary object. Well, maybe that's it, a boundary concept that allows us to talk across fields that are too frequently siloed. We understand that for some people, security is a scare word. It is so thoroughly entwined with SWAT teams and heavily armed militaries in the favelas of Brazil, or the focus group done with women in South Africa, for whom security was a scare word. They wanted safety, right? And so I do think that people-centered approach, that won't go away, because I do think it's such an important corrective. So in sum, human security, an important turn in security studies, and one that will have long-lasting resonance, even if the term itself goes out of vogue.
Next, you'll hear from Nath Samaratunga. We discussed his background in public health and its strong overlap with human security, the need for a human security lens in global health education and provision, the role of power in keeping people from freedom, and COVID-19's impact on individuals and communities. I'm super excited to be sitting down, virtually, of course, with our first guest for our podcast, Nath Samaratunga. So Nath, would you like to tell us about yourself?
Definitely. And thank you so much for inviting me on. It's really a big honor, and I'm super excited to be on here. I am currently a Master's of Public Health student at the University of Minnesota, studying public health administration and policy. Before coming to the world of public health, I studied cognitive and brain science and entrepreneurial leadership at Tufts University. My background is in neuroscience as well as entrepreneurship, and I am also an aspiring physician and hope to one day impact health through health policy and direct primary care provision.
Excellent. Thank you. So as we are a Journal of Human Security, we do like to bring in different disciplines and think about how this term and this field of study impacts really a lot of the different global challenges that we're all collectively facing. So being that you're from a different discipline than the traditional international relations or security lens, what does human security mean to you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. For me, basically the removal of barriers that stifle human potential and well-being. And from my understanding, these barriers can range vastly from oppressive policies to human trafficking to poverty to war. And It's actually kind of funny because the more I learn or hear about human security, the more it just sounds more and more synonymous to public health, which is basically just the mitigation of social determinants to physical and social well-being. And maybe this is just my liberal arts bias coming out, but it's really just my firm belief that all fields, no matter how niche or siloed they seem to be, are intersectional and interdisciplinary in nature. Just thinking about public health alone, yes, you need the obvious access to healthcare and health systems to reach health equity, but you also need economic equity, and that requires, one, an understanding of economic theory, but also access to equitable jobs, and that is inherently tied to equal access to education, and that requires access to affordable housing, and all of that is related to racial justice. So each of these seemingly disparate fields inevitably affect and confound each other. So in my view, human security is economic health, which is racial health, which is civic health, which is public health.
When I think of security issues, and more specifically human security issues, my mind does not jump immediately to health. I think the origins of human security stem from this idea that traditional security studies are too state-centric. It's about these nation-states and how they want to protect their borders. And we often understand that through a militaristic lens or the use of force. So in thinking about human security as being for individuals and communities rather than the state, how does health interact with or come into play with these ideas that we traditionally think of as security, such as civil wars or military conflicts or genocides or gendered? I think a lot of the time these physical security conflicts we see often also have gendered impacts. I would love to hear more about the health component in that, because I think that that's something that often gets buried, but obviously is very essential to sustaining the well-being of individuals and communities. If you don't have your health and your health isn't being prioritized, you really don't have anything. So I would love to hear more from you about how health is interacting with all of those things.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely biased. I will say I'm definitely biased. I think I just see health in everything. But I think yeah, the way you put it is actually is very accurate. I think just health is the driving factor in a lot of different opportunities that we're able to take advantage of. If you don't have your health, you're not able to be economically sustained, then you're not able to have access to housing or nutritious food or impact policy even. So I think that just at a very inherent level is why health is so is such a key player in so many different fields. But in terms of issues of security, I think that health interestingly serves as both a cause and effect for a lot of them. Because naturally, I think the very overt idea, which is, I believe is true, is just like your health will be impacted by these major traumatic events. If there's a war, obviously the people physically involved in the fighting in the war would be their health would be impacted, but so too would be the health of community members in the countries that are being impacted, and also even people who aren't in the country but who are family members or have close ties to people in that country will have severe impacts on their health, even if through mental health, which will then have an impact on physical health. That has been shown through a variety of studies on just cardiology and pulmonary effects. There's been a lot of work showing that traumatic social events can have traumatic physical ramifications as well. So I think it's easy to see health as an effect of a lot of these, but I think in a lot of cases, they also can be a root cause to a lot of these social shifts. I think a very hot topic one is just thinking about reproductive health and thinking about how that has caused a lot of social conflict and how that has like resulted in violence against women and children, how that's just become extremely divisive when the root cause is just health itself, but it also so easily ties into social values, sometimes religion, sometimes cultural norm and policy, and economics as well. And so I think because health is so intersectional, I think it can easily draw in a lot of other fields and factors that can then percolate into a major social movement that are ultimately related to security, human security specifically. Just very quickly, I guess, like on the issue of reproductive health, I think it also brings into the equation the idea of just marginalized groups. And I think marginalized groups and the impact societal shifts have on them are very apparent through their health. I think health can be a very strong indicator of the impacts of social shifts on women, on children, on minorities. And actually, I've seen that these indicators can be, I mean, sadly, they're like, they just help us hold a mirror up to ourselves and the existing cracks that are there in our system in healthcare and also in social policy. And it just shows us where we have existing gaps that we need to address. So even just thinking about how, a recent study done by Dr. Rachel Hardeman has shown that Black babies in the U.S. are more likely to die at birth if they're treated by a non-Black doctor. And it's horrific because you think that, you know, like all of these healthcare providers are providing equal care, but really there are a lot of underlying social issues that perpetuate an inequity in health for marginalized communities. And so that, for example, that's just, it shows an indication that, one, there's a major disconnect because there's such drastic differences in health outcomes based on who is providing care, especially along racial lines. And then also, it can show an indicator to a lack of diversity in the physician workforce as well. And it just makes us consider, oh, why is that? What can we do to address that? How can we make sure that these health outcomes that are very clearly avoidable are avoided?
And have you encountered human security as you're pursuing an academic and professional career in medicine? And if so, tell us about that.
Yeah, and interestingly, my direct education on human security comes less from my background in academic medicine and more, or pre-medicine, and more through my public health studies and just conversation about current events like the opioid epidemic and COVID naturally and migrant health. And actually, the more I learn about just the medical education system here in the US, I'm realizing that conversations about human security are almost completely absent in U.S. medical education curricula, which for me is extremely troubling. It's my sense that there's this widely held belief, at least in the medical community, that physicians serve as a sort of panacea, curing all ailments with pure science, but in actuality, it's been shown that direct patient care only addresses 10% of health, whereas the other 90% is through addressing just social determinants and societal events and their impact on people through social changes and policy. And so for me, at least just from my mindset, I don't understand how you could possibly claim to understand a whole patient if you don't understand their housing situation or how they're able to purchase prescriptions if they're low income and not allowed Medicaid if their state didn't expand. So I think that I've had a few, I've dipped my toes into the world of human security through public health, but I really think there needs to be more conversation about human security in medicine in order for patients to truly get the holistic care that they deserve and also pay for, and also just to create a more equitable healthcare system in general.
And though the term human security may not be driving the work of healthcare professionals right now, what role do you think it plays in shaping global health outcomes?
So, for a little bit of background, just based on what I've learned, there are sort of three phases of global health as it's evolved over the course of its existence. So, the first phase sort of started in the early 19th century, and it basically was a discovery of the world model. So physicians, usually from the quote global north, would go to the global south and just broaden their own horizons and use and use global health as a reason to explore unknown lands to them. And then phase two, which I believe we're still currently in, took on the charity-based model of global health. So that was seen in a huge surge of medical mission trips, mission hospitals, people going to, quote, save countries and communities that had less than the communities that were coming to save them. And first of all, there are a lot of examples of that being more harmful than beneficial. I know even anecdotally, just hearing stories about people who came to Sri Lanka, where my parents are from, after the tsunami, a lot of medical mission trips came to Sri Lanka to provide aid, diagnosed a large group of Sri Lankans with what they believed to be mental health disorders instead of just what were actually just cultural differences in addressing pain and grieving. These people were prescribed drugs by these external physicians and then ended up a large portion of them ended up becoming addicted to these drugs that they didn't even need because they were prescribed them by people who didn't really understand their culture or physical needs even, which also just shows the subjective nature of medicine. And it's what I believe to be its nature as an art more than an actual science. That is sort of the second phase of global health that I believe we're in now. And that is the phase that I think would benefit from just incorporation of human security conversations. Because even in that example, we can see that understanding of cultural norms and understanding about barriers that are discussed through the field of human security so greatly impact health. And it is those discussions about an understanding of those human security topics that would allow more proper care and even more effective care of patients in the field of global health. And so, yes, you require the hard science of medicine and biological sciences, but you also need to meld that with cultural norms, societal norms, and there needs to be a lot more discussion about human security in allowing for like more beneficial care in the global health sense. Global health, people don't really understand or acknowledge this, but the US is a part of global health. It's not as if global health just means the entire globe except for the US, or all countries except for the country that's, quote, providing. I think there's just a very flawed definition that hasn't been fully fleshed out by a lot of people who are explicitly learning about it in an academic context. So, and I think that just makes it hard to have a continuous process of bidirectional teaching and learning between different countries, and just makes it a one-sided give and not take. So I think there's not a lot of discussion about the negative impacts that global health can have, because while it's well-intentioned, I also think it's a way for honestly somewhat elite institutions and very privileged institutions and individuals to pat themselves on the back and make themselves feel like they're making an impact, and that they're, and also it, at the end of the day, I think it also just feels like them excusing, and I was also a part of this, and just us excusing ourselves from the contributions that we provide to a system that keeps all of these people at a disadvantage. There's this really great book by Anand Giriharadas called Winners Take All that basically describes how philanthropy and service and charity are at its peak right now in the U.S. There's just more giving that's ever been in the history of the U.S., but also we're seeing the greatest disparities in terms of income, in terms of educational achievement than we've ever seen. And the book discusses how a lot of that is because the people who are giving, the people who are privileged enough to have money and connections and the ability to provide this, quote, charity, they give in a way that keeps them at the top of the system instead of reshaping the system so that, yes, they would have to sacrifice being at the top. They would have to sacrifice some of their power, but that would, that's just vital in terms of making sure that there's a sustainable impact, a sustainable positive impact on the people at the bottom. And if you just think about social, if you just think about social movements in the past, the people at the top do have to sacrifice in order for people at the bottom, or the people who are being disadvantaged, to gain something. I mean, if you think about women's suffrage, men had to give up their absolute power in the democracy to give women the right to vote. If you think about civil rights, white people had to give up their absolute power that they held in order to create a more equitable union. And so there's this whole big idea about how in every single situation there can be a win-win scenario, but I also think we need to come to terms with the fact that sometimes some people have to lose something in order to create an overall benefit. And I think that's something that we all have to come to terms with globally, especially in the field of global health, in order to make the impact that we claim to be making. And also I think we want to make that impact, we just don't realize the negative repercussions that we're making in the process.
If you have more thoughts or ideas on this restructuring of the hierarchy or the system, or what can be done to make more sustainable models, it was a very interesting point if you wanted to expound.
It's a really good question, and it's something that I'm actively grappling with right now and having just a lot of conversations about. I think something that has come to, that has percolated to the top of a lot of conversations that I've had recently, is just sourcing solutions from the, quote, from the bottom. So just creating a very bottoms-up approach to creating systemic change. I think a lot of, well, for one thing, I think a lot of people, even people who do want to create large-scale change, who end up working their way up the ladder, sometimes get lost in the system that's perpetuating all of these different systemic issues. And also, as you climb the ladder and are able to create large-scale change, I think it's also hard to know the niche needs of specific communities. So I think partnering with people who are on the ground, ideally people who are actually a part of those communities, and letting them fuel first, letting people in the communities that you're trying to help define the problems at hand, define them as problems, see if the problems that you're placing upon them are actually problems that they identify as problems, and then two, having them provide the solutions that they think would be sustainable within people in their community, so that one, they don't need to create a dependence on these external factors and people, and also so that it's aligned with their cultural values and community values and norms.
And from this global health perspective, what do you perceive as some of the greatest threats to the security of individuals and communities today? Obviously with the caveat that you are not from these specific communities, but if there are any general trends that you can extrapolate as current issues in this system?
I think there are just a few hot topics that a lot of us in these academic institutions discuss a lot. So climate change, economic equity, access to healthcare. I think those are all big ones. For me, what I keep coming back to personally is just a lack of humility in a lot of these efforts. And I see this both in global health efforts, and just public policy and public health efforts in general, especially so during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm just thinking about how in global health education, it is, like I said, a lot of it is very one-directional. And I think there's a lack of understanding that you being the global north, might not have all of the answers, and that's why global health education as a field is so valuable, because it means education on both sides. And so I think there's a lack of understanding that you might not have all the answers, and there is learning to be done from both sides of the equation. And so, and I think just this closed off approach to the education model in general makes it really difficult. And you can even see that in global health programs across the world. I was looking at a recent study about global health partnerships between medical schools in the US and medical schools in 3 or 4 countries in Africa, and just the barrier, and looking at specifically medical student exchange programs between these different institutions, and the barriers, the specific requirements and forms and trainings that students in Africa need to go through to come and do rotations at US institutions are way, way, way more complex than the other way around. And even that alone is quite problematic, because if you're thinking about these US medical students who have the same amount of education, who have very limited education, being not even trained physicians yet, coming and rotating and providing some sort of care to, you know, patients in other countries of the world, and with minimal training and prep beforehand, I think that's also just very telling. And just thinking about how, the double standard between these different countries in terms of programming, I think just makes it really difficult, and that just comes back to the lack of humility.
We're coming up on the end of our first episode, but before I let Noth go, I wanted to discuss COVID-19 as a global security threat, how some countries have adopted a community-oriented response, and his work with healthcare expert Andy Slavitt. On the note of COVID-19 vaccine deployment, I saw that NPR reported that, I believe it's Moderna's supply or Pfizer's supply, that the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, Canada, and Japan have already purchased over 90% of the available supply. So I guess that sort of touches on these themes you've been bringing up throughout this interview about the global north versus the global south. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about sort of in the way that we can visibly see that hegemony of these nations claiming a majority of the supply for a virus that has harmed all of us in the world. And of course, some countries more than others. What does it mean that in our global system that even vaccine scarcity becomes this pitting of a certain part of the world's countries gaining this at the detriment to the rest of the world? And if you've thought about that, or if there are conversations about that going on in your field.
I hope that people will realize that we need to rely more on each other and we need to care more about each other as a global community. Because, ultimately, even if you want to think in a selfish way, we're not getting out of this pandemic until all of us globally are safe. Because, like it or not, we live in a very connected world. People have family all around the world, businesses all around the world. We're going to continue mixing and migrating and moving around and transferring goods. And so inevitably, even if we think about how this pandemic started, it started in one country and it very quickly spread to every single other. So we need to, even for our own sake, we need to start caring about each other and realize that we're not all getting better until we're all getting better. Since the start of the summer, I had the amazing opportunity to work as a research assistant for Andy Slavitt, who was the former acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid under President Obama, and is now a leading figure in fighting against the COVID-19 pandemic and spearheading a lot of the U.S. responses to the pandemic in terms of health policy. And I helped out with a lot of just research tasks for him in this effort, and also was primarily helping with the book that he's publishing that's coming out in March of 2021. It's called Preventable, and I highly recommend it. I think it's amazing. But it also, for me, it was just such a valuable opportunity, both because I just think the world of Andy and think he's just, we need more people like him who very clearly show that his efforts in impacting health are rooted in human experiences. For those who don't know, he was brought into the healthcare system because of his best friend experiencing brain cancer, and then and he's publicly talked about seeing how his friend's wife had to deal with these different medical bills that she was unable to pay, showed him how flawed our U.S. healthcare system is, and has led to his success and accomplishments after that. And so for me, it's just been refreshing to see some healthcare leader who's actually rooted in human experience and trying to make that easier for a lot of people across the nation. But it's also been really valuable to see how a lot of the public health knowledge that I've been gaining in an academic sense can actually manifest. Some conversations that I've had with him is thinking about how different countries responded to the pandemic, and how there's actually a pretty clear division in terms of COVID-19 responses, national responses, and prevalence and infection rates, along the lines of egalitarianism of specific countries. So if we look at countries that have extreme wealth and extreme lack of wealth, so like the US and the UK, Peru and Mexico, they've had a lot worse health outcomes from COVID-19 than countries that have more well-distributed wealth across different levels of income in their country. So for example, like Japan and Australia and South Korea, they all did relatively well in the fight against COVID. And it's just been interesting to think about how a lot of those inequities are fueled by social norms in those specific countries. Early on in the pandemic, I was struck by just seeing family members in Sri Lanka handling the pandemic versus my experience here in the US, and thinking about how the communal culture of a lot of South Asian countries that I have family in were able to deal with COVID a lot better than us in the US with a very much more individualistic culture. So I remember for the longest time, I think from March until August, Sri Lanka only had 9 deaths in the entire country from COVID. And for reference, Sri Lanka is a third the size of Minnesota with one third, or a third the size of Minnesota with three times the population. So you would think was just a very densely populated island that once COVID got in, everyone would have it. But because they shut down extremely quickly, and were able to utilize their military to distribute food and supplies, but also because they were able to watch out for each other, the effects were just very, very apparent. So whenever anyone tested positive, government members would put a sign on their door saying, "Neighbors, just a heads up, this person has COVID. Make sure they don't go outside, but also it is your duty as neighbors to make sure that they have food delivered to them, that they have supplies delivered to them, that you constantly check up on them. This is their number. Call them." And people actually acted upon it. And I think just seeing that they were able to trust the citizens of their country to have a communal mindset versus an individual mindset, and seeing how that played out in just the positive outcomes of COVID for them, it's really telling. Because it shows that cultural values are more than just cultural values. They can also have significant human impact. And there's potentially learning that can be done across cultural norms for the benefit of just, like, the global community.
Wow. I really thank you for sharing that anecdote. I think that really nicely crystallizes this importance in pivoting our point of views from being so macro or statewide, because there is a lot of power and resilience in individuals who comprise these communities. I mean, based off of what you're saying, like, spread was largely able to be contained or curbed because these individuals were taking the onus on themselves to act appropriately, but also to be vigilant and empathetic about their neighbors and make sure that they were supported emotionally, but also resource-wise. You mentioned that the military was able to be mobilized to deliver supplies, but even beyond that, the security and stability of these individuals and their communities was coming from that micro level. And that's interesting to think about comparatively because, as you said, we're both in the United States. I haven't heard of anybody who has had that experience here personally. I would be surprised to find people who have. It really does speak to this difference in cultural values, but also, as you very articulately and eloquently put it, that cultural values are more than cultural values. They can have very serious impacts on human security and stability.
A huge thank you to Professor Tyden and to Nath Samaratunga for being our first guest for our podcast here at Praxis, the Fletcher Journal of Human Security. And a big thank you to the Praxis team for their support and efforts in getting this podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoyed listening, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at @Fletcher_Praxis, and you can like us on Facebook or connect with us on LinkedIn to stay up to date on new print, web, and podcast content.